Our next speaker is Peter Brown. He's a professor of experimental neurology at the University of Oxford and has made many seminal discoveries about oscillations and dynamics and Parkinson's disease and related topics. And his title of his talk today will be Basal Ganglia Beta, Idling, Blocking, or Maintaining the Status Quo.
Thank you, and thank you to Nancy and the other organizers for inviting me and for putting together such a fabulous weekend. 2 days. So now, just to start off with the objectives of the talk, what I'd like to do is really focus on the human and demonstrate how study of pathology can provide clues about normal function of oscillations and vice versa. And I'd also like to provide an exemplar of how neuromodulatory systems can impact on oscillatory synchrony and function. So I'm going to go through this part of the talk, the first half, rather quickly, and then I'm going to go to the second half, which is to introduce some novel interventions that we can apply in the human, which may be of therapeutic benefit, but they also happen to provide strong evidence that oscillatory synchrony is causally important. So how do we get to study the basal ganglia in humans? Well, we take advantage of poor patients with Parkinson's disease. And let me just start this off. In the advanced state, these patients have a stimulator implanted into the basal ganglia, usually the subthalamic nucleus. This is a patient with such a stimulator. It's off at the moment. They're off their medication. They're very slow. They're very stiff. They're rigid. That's freezing a block to movement. And in a second, you'll see the individual turn on the stimulator, and almost instantaneously, there is an improvement with flow of gestures. Not complete improvement. There's still stiffness, but a dramatic change. In the process of that surgery, either intraoperatively, we can record single neurons or multiple neurons within the surgical target, usually the subthalamic nucleus. And simultaneously, we can record the local field potential by changing the passband of what we record. And you can see that both consist of this rhythm of about, in this instance, I think it's about 16 hertz. And they're in tandem. So the LFP is a good surrogate, a marker of this synchronization at the neuronal level. And we can do a few more fancy tests postoperatively before the electrodes that are implanted are connected to the subcutaneous pacemaker. And from those larger electrodes, we can also record local field potentials, which have a similar structure. So then to the hypothesis for the first part of the talk, and it's always good to have a hypothesis so we can rubbish it and then move on. So this is a pretty basic hypothesis, and this is really that increasing beta synchronization, what I showed you in the last slide, locally in the basal ganglia or in the motor cortical areas linked to the basal ganglia, as that increases, it drives us along this curve. At this end, we have, we're in a state, a motor set, where we can readily move. We can move briskly, fast, often with a short reaction time. At this end, we're in a motor set where we resist movement. So for you and I, it might be if we're traveling on the tube and we're holding on and we want to resist perturbations, we stiffen up and avoid movement. But this can become extreme, and in Parkinson's disease, we move right down here, and then we see the impairments that I illustrated in that video. And the crux of this hypothesis is that this set point of where you are in your beta will shift, and that's under the influence of dopaminergic tone. And in addition, there is a dynamic, more local shift here, which depends on task demands. So in providing the support for this theory and arguing in its favor, I'm going to make a couple of assumptions, which are all unwarranted. And the first is that beta is one generic activity. Well, that's clearly nonsense. There are probably many activities overlapping in this band, but I think we can characterize the bulk of the activity in this hypothesis. The second assumption is that I'm going to draw evidence from both the basal ganglia end and also the cortical end. And they are linked anatomically in well-described motor loops. And more recently, we've been able to see that they're functionally linked in the human by recording the local field potential, as I described, and simultaneously MEG activity, and showing that there's this very clear coherence between the two. But there's a sleight of hand here in that the coherence, even though we've got these tremendous peaks, is only 0.2. That means that we're predicting about 20% of the variance of the cortical oscillations from the depth. So although I'm going to draw evidence from the cortex, I think there is a question about just how these are locked, and there is obviously some independence at the cortex. And then finally, as we've heard, I'm going to assume beta works in isolation. That, again, is nonsense. There are complementary rhythms, particularly the high-frequency rhythms, and there's cross-frequency coupling that I won't go into. So very quickly, this is very classical physiology here now, and this is what we imagine is happening in health. So the classical bit is in health in the cortex, where we know that if you make a movement, if we follow this black line, we get a beta desynchronization just before the movement, this drop here. And so this is the dynamic movement down this way to prepare you for the movement. Perhaps a little less known is that if you have to inhibit a movement, stop a prepotent movement response, either in a stop task where you have to stop midway or in a no-go task, what you get then is an upregulation of this beta activity. And we happen to see precisely the same in what we presume is more or less than healthy basal ganglia in that it's non-Parkinsonian. And we can access that by recording from these structures in patients with dystonia who are not Parkinsonian. And we have a very similar effect that during movement there's a beta drop, this arrow going down, and if we have a no-go paradigm, we have a beta increase, which is this local increase here. Now, I've put this down here, and it's difficult to estimate what kind of synchronization we see in the normal state, but there's this interesting and recent paper from the Toronto group, which again took advantage of looking at patients with dystonia in the globus pallidus interna and contrasting them with patients with Parkinson's disease. And in dystonia, unitary discharge is able to predict, in other words, it correlates with about 10% of the variance in the LFP. So this gives us an intuition as to how synchronized neurons are in the normal state. So what happens in Parkinson's disease? Well, obviously, there's this shift up. So we become more synchronized, judging from those records I showed you before. And we can actually get an intuition of how synchronized we get from these studies here. This one's from the rodent that we did in collaboration with Pete McGill. And the 6-hydroxydopamine midbrain lesioned rodent, which is a Parkinsonian model. And what it shows in black is the lesioned animals, the Parkinsonian animals. And this is the coherence, or the transformed coherence, between the multi-unit activity and the local field potential. And there's this prominent peak in the beta band, and that gets up to about 0.25, which again means about 25% of prediction. The Weinberger group in Toronto did something similar in GPI and dystonics. They find about 35% of prediction, and this seems fairly consistent across the literature. So there's at least a threefold strengthening of the synchronization in Parkinson's disease. Why does this become more synchronized? Well, I'd argue, and I'll show you more evidence, that this is because of the change in dopaminergic tone. So if we lose dopaminergic tone, we move across this axis. It's difficult to, if not impossible, to record healthy subjects, but what we can do is return to our patients with dystonia, and occasionally doctors treat them with a drug called tetrabenazine, which makes them Parkinsonian. If we contrast those patients, those depth recordings, in patients with dystonia treated with tetrabenazine, and those with the same condition but not treated with tetrabenazine, so this is iatrogenic Parkinsonism, we see this beta peak. Now, tetrabenazine depletes vesicles of monoamines, particularly dopamine. So this is a model that suggests that that as we move up this way with less and less a dopaminergic tone, we are synchronizing our beta. I think it's valuable to remember that the dynamics during task in this pathological state are more or less, they're not precisely similar, but they're kind of similar to the healthy state. So just as we saw a desynchronization when healthy subjects moved, either at the cortical level or in alternative diagnoses where we record from the depth, we see this beta desynchronization when PD patients move. And in a stop task, so we fully cue a response, and then we have a low frequency of targets that say don't move, so that the individual has to suppress a prepotent response, then we see a nice beta increase that starts before the reaction time would have been. So speaking in favor of this being under dopaminergic control and addressing the question of what happens when we treat Parkinson's disease. Well, we usually treat that with levodopa, which is dopamine prodrug. And when we give that, this is group data from patients recorded in the subthalamic nucleus. Patients off medication have this nice beta peak. On medication, on levodopa, that's suppressed. We're moving down this axis. We would argue that they should then improve, and indeed, there's a nice relationship between the percentage reduction in this beta power and the percentage improvement in bradykinesia and rigidity. This is an R squared of 0.6, which is really quite respectable. As I showed you in that video, another dramatic treatment is deep brain stimulation, when we stimulate targets like the subthalamic nucleus at very high frequency, 130 hertz, and patients get better. We would predict, therefore, that they're getting better because we're shifting this set point down into the physiological range, and indeed, that's what we can now show with some reasonably fancy amplifiers, which allow us to record simultaneously the local field potential, which is only a few microvolts, during stimulation, which is involving several volts. This is a real-time recording during stimulation that is being ramped up, and we come to clinically effective voltages here, and there is a beta band activity at rest and during low-voltage stimulation, and then we get to our clinical threshold, and it dies away over several seconds. It remains suppressed. We turn off. It comes back after several seconds, and it's there on presentation. Well, that's all very well, and I've raced through that because it is simply correlative evidence. So it might all be epiphenomenal, and what really we have to do is to seek some evidence of causality. And we started to do this by using TACS, transcranial alternating current stimulation, which is a simple intervention where you pass a current, a very small current through the cortex. And by alternating this current, we can entrain neurons in its field, and this has been shown by Buzecki and others. And indeed, if we do this and we stimulate with 20 hertz, we can show that there's entrainment because we can follow corticomuscular coupling, which is essentially the overflow of the pyramidal neurons being entrained to the muscle, and that increases during stimulation. So this affords us a straightforward way of testing the hypothesis in healthy subjects. We should stimulate over their motor cortex at 20 hertz. They should get slower. We did a paradigm with a cued joystick movement as quickly as possible, and we contrasted 5 and 20 hertz. 5 hertz did nothing. 20 hertz does slow the movement. So proof of principle, okay, but it's trivial. It's significant, but trivial, the slowing. So now if you think about Parkinson's disease, patients are 50% more slow. So we're not approaching that. We were disappointed with that, so we thought, well, why is that? And one possibility is that we were stimulating when patients were moving. And we know that the normal cortex would change its resonance patterns during that period because of the task, and the spontaneous beta would be suppressed. So maybe we're testing it in a state where the cortex is not readily engaged by a beta, whether intrinsic or extrinsic. And we went back to think about that no-go experiment that I described, where you stop movement that has been pre-prepared or in a prepotent response. And under those circumstances, we get a nice beta increase. So the resonance pattern of the cortex actually favors beta. So we thought, well, what happens then if we give this beta stimulation during no-go trials? So we repeated the experiment, but it included no-go trials. And here we got healthy subjects to squeeze a dynamometer as hard and quickly as they could. In the standard trials, this now is blue is without stimulation. Red, I'm just going to show you beta stimulation. We also did higher frequency stimulation. There is a tiny change for the worse during stimulation. So the peak rate of the squeezing is significantly reduced, but it's even worse than before. But the major question is, what happens in the no-go trials? Now, obviously, many of those trials are suppressed successfully, but some of the trials, about 40% in this paradigm by playing with the actual paradigm, about 40% are attenuated responses. So these are responses where you don't squeeze as hard as you possibly can, but you make an attenuated squeeze. So this is without stimulation, this blue, and these attenuated responses, this is partially inhibited because, look, it's about a third of the maximal peak rate. What happens now if we stimulate during this state where we suspect that the cortical resonance is set by the context in our favor? And now we see about over a 30% suppression in this. And this is very interesting because not only are we approaching the Parkinsonian degree of deficit, but it's not a deficit because of the task. This is actually an improvement in function. So the degree of synchronization is functional consequence, is also a consequence of context. So here we're doing something that is reducing movement, but it's appropriate. There's another opportunity for testing causality, and that is to go back to our patients with their stimulators and not stimulate them at 130 hertz, but stimulate them at 20 hertz in the beta range. And the prediction is obvious that they should slow down. And there are a couple of studies now, and this is the study from us that shows the biggest effect of stimulation. and essentially got patients to make a maximal contraction as quickly as possible again during stimulation. And during stimulation, there is a significant drop in the speed with which they make this contraction, so they're more bradykinetic. But the effect size, again, is a bit small. It's about 22%. Now, if you take somebody's levodopa away from them, they're about 50% worse. So this is a bit short of absolute proof. I mean, it's a proof of principle, but it's short of the full replication of what we want. Now, that may be because we're adding beta to patients with a lot of beta already, so we've got a ceiling effect. Probably the biggest problem is that because we're using these electrical stimulators, we can only give one pulse per cycle, and that's not really very physiological. And fortunately, Gradinaru et al., in their article looking at the mechanism of action of high-frequency stimulation of the subthalamic nucleus, as one of their controls, instead of stimulating at high frequency, they stimulated at low frequency, which was 20 hertz, and they found that there was a very substantial increase in their surrogate measure of Parkinsonism, which in this model is ipsilateral apomorphine-induced turning. So that effect is equivalent in size to the DBS effect. So why this functional dependency on the degree of synchronization? Well, I think we can go back to some first principles and think about our local population of neurons in this schematic. And there are two conflicting processes. First, there is the information that can be fed forwards. And as an ensemble becomes more and more synchronized and more extensive, that information that can be fed forwards through this population is going to drop. So there's a limit to the information transfer that will be possible. But at the same time, because we're synchronizing, what we're doing is we're increasing the signal-to-noise ratio, the power of the signal that we want to transmit. And if we put these together, then we get this interesting trade-off, which I've called here ensemble performance. So there will be a degree of synchronization where actually further synchronization is improving matters because we're improving signal-to-noise ratio. But then we'll hit a peak of this inverted U relationship. And then as we synchronize more, we're actually going to cost the system because we're reducing information and we're barely making much difference to signal-to-noise ratio. So if you think of the ridiculous extreme, when everything's synchronized here, we can only have one channel of information going through. And I think what's interesting is things like the beta normally probably sit here in terms of the degree of synchronization, so they can desynchronize and improve performance. But they can also hypersynchronize when, for example, when we don't want to move in the no-go situation, they can synchronize some more and turn down the performance of that system. But in Parkinson's disease, we're right down here. And very quickly, is there any evidence to support this idea? Yes, there is, in that the spatial extent of synchronization correlates with motor impairment in PD. That's both at the cortical level and also at the level of the subthalamic nucleus. And we can actually use information theory to quantify this. This is data from the rodent Michigan probe going through the subthalamic nucleus. And what happens in the Parkinsonian animal is that we get more mutual information between these different sites within the subthalamic nucleus. In other words, there is more redundancy of that information because we're replicating it throughout the nucleus. Now, I don't actually think this is the whole story, but I will leave that perhaps for the discussion. So an interim summary. Whether a given degree of physiological synchronization leads to functional benefit or impairment actually depends on task. Levels of neuromodulators like dopamine, and here I've described dopamine's tonic mode, not its phasic mode, can bias the set point of synchronization. An exaggerated beta in the setting of deficient tonic dopamine seems to be linked to slowness and stiffness in Parkinson's disease, but most of the evidence is correlative, and in the human so far, it's fallen short of describing the whole shift to Parkinson's. So we need new interventions in which to test causality and also to capitalize on our understanding for treatment. And so in the second half of the talk, I'd like to go through some of these interventions. And the first is to try and modify deep brain stimulation itself. So as I explained, we get quite good responses from stimulating at very high frequency, but we stimulate patients at very high frequency all the time. The battery runs out, they get side effects, it's not totally effective. If beta really is causally important, then why not just trigger the stimulation to when beta is high in the basal ganglia? And this is something that we've just recently done. That I can describe that to you perhaps if you're interested afterwards. I think this is more interesting, which is the actual practicality of what we did in patients. What we did was we recorded in the subthalamic nucleus. This is raw LFP, and over time you can see these bursts, these nice bursts of beta. We filtered that around the individual's optimal beta frequency, and there's some variation between subjects, patients. So you can see a nice beta burst there. And then we rectified that and put a moving average for it, very simple stuff. And then you've got this demodulated beta power, if you like. And simply we put a threshold for it, which would give us about 50% of on time of stimulation and 50% of off time of stimulation. And we chose 50% because we thought 50% savings on battery, that's actually quite a lot. So a very practical threshold. And when it crosses this threshold, we kick in our stimulation. There's a ramp so that people don't feel tingling. And then when it crosses back down, we turn the stimulation off. We tried several blocks. We contrasted everything to no stimulation, to continuous stimulation, because we wanted to see how adaptive or closed-loop stimulation fared compared to that. But an important block is this random DBS block, because not only are we triggering off beta bursts here, but we're also providing intermittent stimulation. So it could be that just intermittent stimulation is what we need, and we forget about any locking to beta. So how do we fare with all that? Well, I'll just show you the clinical results, and these were replicated in blinded video assessments. Nice response. This is a good response post-operatively to continuous DBS in these patients, about a 50% improvement. Adaptive DBS did actually better, the significant improvement. And interestingly, Haggai Bergman last year, in a different closed-loop situation in the MPTP-treated monkey, also showed that adaptive DBS performed better. But perhaps the most interesting thing is this random control, which is matched for on-time stimulation. That is not nearly as effective. So it really does seem to be the timing with respect to these beta bursts that's critical. A few other things. The on-time was about 44%, and that means that we've got over a 50% improvement in energy delivered. So that's substantial. But another interesting thing was that over time, although we kept this fixed beta threshold, the time on drops. In other words, there's the suggestion that by timing our stimulation to occur with the beta bursts, we're inducing some plasticity, some beneficial plasticity in the system. So summary so far, good correlative evidence, sufficient to trial beta DBS in a closed loop mode, But can we go a step further and develop adaptive electrical interventions that specifically target pathological oscillations? And this is the very last bit of the talk. The obvious thing would be for us to try this out in beta. But as I've explained, although I think beta is certainly a contributor, at the moment we cannot be sure that it's quantitatively important in driving Parkinsonism in patients. So we chose a different model to look at, and that's the model of Parkinsonian tremor, not Achinesian rigidity. And it's well known that there's coherence between peripheral tremor and the motor cortex, and from old studies done in the 50s and earlier, where surgeons, desperate to treat patients before levodopa, tried sectioning the pyramidal tract or extirpating, cutting out the cortex in patients, that would abolish tremor. Obviously, it would make them have a flaccid hemiparesis as well, which is a bit of a waste of time. But at least it provides us proof that the cortex is causally mediating tremor, Parkinsonian tremor. We have an intervention, which was our TACS, and what we needed was a control algorithm to try and actually suppress the rhythm that we think is causative. And we didn't come up with this. This is an old-fashioned engineering solution from the 1950s, which was introduced for pilots, and now you probably readily use it when you travel in active noise cancellation headphones. And these essentially just pick up their headphones with a microphone that picks up the noise from the engine. And really, John Wayne here wants to hear the conning tower. So they pick up this noise, and then they chuck out through the loudspeaker a mirror image of that noise. There's cancellation, and John Wayne can hear his conning tower, and you can hear your Mozart on the plane, etc. So could we do something in principle similarly, and this again is poor man's optogenetics, in patients? So we have our pathological activity. Can we give a signal that's the mirror image of that and come back with what's left, which is restored function? So there is a problem here in that we want to cancel the cortical signal that underlies the tremor, the 5 or 10 hertz cortical oscillation, but we can't record that without putting a dural grid or electrode on the surface. That's invasive. We don't want to do that in this proof of principle study. We want something non-invasive. And so what we can do is we can trade on the fact that the cortex is driving the tremor and does so with a fixed delay. We know that from coherence studies. So we can actually look at the phase of our stimulation with respect to the tremor. And at some point with respect to the tremor, we will be potentially able to phase reinforce our cortical oscillations, and then we should actually get an increased tremor with our TACS. And with another phase relationship to the tremor, we should happen to be cancelling the underlying cortical oscillations and cancel tremor. So what we did in a couple of patients is we tracked the tremor phase and went right through the whole phase cycle in increments, stimulating for 30 seconds. And we did indeed find periods of excitation and suppression, which were quite substantial with these 30 seconds of stimulation. So about 50% effects here. And nicely, they're in antiphase. So this is what we find in practice. So this now is phase tracking of tremor. And we're tracking the phase at the optimal phase for tremor suppression. This is the phase alignment between the tremor and the TACS that we're imposing on the cortex. When it kicks in, there's a nice abrupt reduction in the tremor. But what's encouraging, more encouraging than that, is as we go over time, the tremor actually begins to fizzle out. So again, we might be tapping into plasticity with this this approach. So to summarize that, with this technique, we're getting about 40-50% tremor suppression. It's early days. We can improve on that, I think. But it's a very intriguing intervention because it's highly selective. Because it's phase cancellation, we're selectively picking out from the brain that signal that we're interested in targeting, and other activities that are not phase coupled to the tremor or to the stimulus will be relatively unaffected, even if they're at the same frequency. So it could be a very selective way of treating, and it could be a feasible approach in other phenotypes if and when the link between oscillatory and synchrony and symptoms becomes more certain. So last slide then, an overall summary. Good correlative evidence linking beta and akinesia and rigidity in Parkinson's disease, sufficient to trial beta as a basis for closed-loop DBS in PD, and this seems in this first proof-of-principle study seems to be effective, which does speak very strongly in support of the fact that there is some link between beta and akinesia rigidity. But also these newer techniques of adaptive closed-loop stimulation and phase cancellation techniques, they can provide further evidence of the causal significance of oscillations in humans and, importantly, opportunities for treatment. So it remains for me to thank my worker bees over here, so I'm just the passive recipient of what they give me, my collaborators and my funders, and like everybody else, I will put up a picture of the group. There we are. It's just to prove that in Europe we're very old school. Thank you. Yes, so that is something that we hope to do. We will combine closed loop with the beta stimulation. So, in fact, we've already done that with tremor. So we've just put in a closed loop element to this control system, so that when the tremor goes, we turn it off. We've just been hesitant to do it with beta because. Because you never like to disprove your own hypothesis.
I'd like to go more to the hypothesis that you said you would leave for discussion. You mentioned that we don't really know if and how beta is driving the Parkinsonian state. And it's fairly controversial, so I would like to know your thinking on it. Why beta?
So when you mean driving, why does it cause the Parkinsonian
why
state?
Why does it cause antikinetic activity?
Yeah.
It's certainly not just synchronous activity per se, because there's a lot of alpha and gamma and delta and other things that can be very synchronous and don't cause antikinetic.
So I gave that old-fashioned explanation about an information lesion, if you like. But that
doesn't explain why beta.
Yeah, exactly. And we know it's that explanation is useless, because if you go back to the DBS story, where we stimulate the subthalamic nucleus at 130 hertz, that's a total information lesion, and yet they get better. So that implies to me that there's something extra that beta's doing. Now, what's that extra? There isn't much to go on, but first off, when we were stimulating in our closed-loop paradigm, we stimulated in short bursts, on average about 800 milliseconds to a second, and yet that improved function all the time. So that implies that the effect of beta outlasts the duration of the beta burst. So that I would like to argue that it's inducing some kind of plastic reinforcement of the status quo. And there's some evidence to suggest that in these studies here that we did a couple of years ago, which showed that the effects of beta in healthy subjects outlasted the duration of the beta burst. So I would argue, with very little evidence, that beta is actually inducing some short-term plasticity that is largely responsible for the block on movement or the biasing towards posture.
Great, you know, introducing feedbacks, right? So it's kind of future which we are going to have. But point is that beta is more complicated, more complex story that you mentioned, because from old Abel Weinberger group, they showed that going through the SDN with single units, the rhythmicity is changing. So beta is only one part of SDN. Of course, we cannot see this in local peak potentials because we are integrating all parts together. Now, the point is that different parts of SDN, they have different functions. So some of them are going to primary motor causes, other to supplementary limbic part is going to the limbic system. Therefore, it looks that beta is kind of instability in one part of the system, but not in others. So we are seeing this by DBS, and DBS is increasing some part of movements, like only some, improve some joints movement, but not all of them, because it depends which part of SDN is stimulated.
So essentially what you're saying is that beta is fairly localized. And that actually works to our advantage because there are a lot of studies now that show that the beta in the SDN is localized to the dorsal motor region of the subthalamic nucleus. So by targeting beta, we potentially can improve motor function. But there are indeed other oscillations outside of the motor regions of the SDN or whichever other basal ganglion nucleus we look at. For example, there's a preponderance of theta activity in the associative areas. And I think the potential is we could become much more sophisticated in 10, 15 years' time. Why should we just control one rhythm? If we have the spatial resolution within the nucleus, we can control several rhythms and trade off against the sort of phenotype, which will be some balance of these rhythms.
So I don't know if I was reading well your graph, but it seems that when you give dopamine to this patient, like beta goes up, but also theta goes drastically down. So I was wondering, like in the first part of your talk, like when there was the shoulder of.
Can you just scream in which one?
Back.
No?
I think it's still back.
No, that's it.
I'll go forward.
Forward. It's like surgery. Back, forward.
Yeah, this one. Sorry.
This one. All right,
no,
so.
Back one.
There we are.
Oh, no.
I'd like to be able to look better.
You moved.
I removed it.
Sorry about that. Go move it. Sorry.
Let's go back. That one.
Yes.
There. Right.
So, am I reading it right? Like, so theta is going, it's actually disappearing?
No. You're reading. So, actually, theta seems to be lower in the off state. Theta actually is higher in the on state, and that
right.
people have argued that that might relate to dyskinesias, and it might also relate, going back to the other question of theta being in the associative cortex, might also relate to the impulse control disorders that these patients have.
So maybe we have time for one more question, and then we have our coffee.
I actually saw it in the slide before this. Really, really.
Is this?
This is like that
one?
Oh, no, that one. That one. There. Okay, so that's the theta band that we're looking at there, right?
Up
above. Yeah.
Here, this thing here, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. All right. What about alpha?
What means an alpha?
Is it completely irrelevant to all of this? Like, if you go to motor cortex, you go to somatosensory cortex, there's this, you know, mu, whatever you want to call it, but it's a Rolandic alpha, and that behaves like beta, it seems, you know, and that you get a desync before movement and so on and so forth. Is that somehow connected to this mechanistically?
In our recordings, we do sometimes see alpha, but so this is group data. This is about 12 STN. There's a little peak that you could say, I don't know if it's alpha. It could be alpha just there. It's not very dramatic in the basal ganglia, and it's not that dramatic in the motor cortex. The mu rhythm, the 10 hertz element of it, seems to be coming more from the sensory cortex, just post-Rolandic.
Let's thank Peter again during the break.